Well, thanks for coming, everybody. This panel is the writing panel about making the grade. And I'd just like to invite the other panellists to introduce themselves first. Jonathan?
I'm Jonathan Schwan. I'm an editor who is based here but mostly works in America.
I'm Teresa Ams. I'm an account manager for HarperCollins. I'm based here in WA.
I'm Bevan McGuinness, an author with HarperCollins. Thank you, Teresa. And I'm based here in WA as well.
I'm Kat Sparks and I'm a writer from Wollongong and formerly an editor as well. Right, well, can I just do a quick round the room? Who here is a writer? Who has any ambitions for your writer? See, you are a writer if you want to be a writer. That's a good place to start. What I wanted to do with this topic was talk about something that I've noticed over the past few years in the processes of writing and submitting stories and getting rejected and all of those sorts of things. I think at the moment we're in a situation where there are more markets than ever, or there seem to be more markets than they ever have been before, but perhaps the level of quality is varying. So that's what I wanted to talk about with the idea of making grade. How good do you have to be to get published, and where should you be looking at getting published? Because as I see it now, getting published is about as easy as falling off a log if you don't have very high standards. Jonathan, do you have any...
Well, the simple observation I would make is I don't think getting published is hard, but keeping getting published is hard. It's not that hard to sell your first story, particularly if you are aiming at a non-professional or semi-professional market. But if you want to keep selling and, you know, build a career of any depth, I think you have to raise the bar. Because wherever you're sitting in a career, there's always somewhere else to go. Whether you're Stephen King or somebody selling the first story, there's a next level. So you always have to be pushing the quality of your work and the way you manage and deal with it to a higher level. If you don't do that, then you'll never, you won't continue to succeed. You'll generally just plateau at some level. What I do see happening is you get people who, for whatever reason, what they tend to do is they get to they get through the door and think, well, that's it, I'm in. And then for whatever reason, they just level at that and they're happy. Yeah. There's nothing inherently wrong with it, but there's an awful lot of mediocre work around as a result.
Yeah, it's the mediocre work that drives me nuts. I'm feeling more and more aggravated towards it all the time because I think it clogs up the scene for everybody else. It brings down the way fantasy, I'll use the word fantasy to encompass fantasy, science fiction, horror, etc. I think it brings the bar down as far as the way our work is perceived in the broader writing community and the reading community. Teresa, do you have any?
It's very difficult, I mean, from a publishing point of view. I think a lot of the problem now seems to be within publishing is in the past, publishers didn't really have to make money, and now they do. They have to be a viable business, and time is short, and whereas once upon a time you could have an editor that would spend a lot of time with you and take your work, which is okay, mediocre, and build it into something that's brilliant, and work with you and encourage you and build you to be the wonderful author you are and give you all the support you need. Where now the editors don't have that time. And I think that's where publishing is suffering. Because, I agree with Jonathan that there are editors who come in, I've made it, I'm in. But they don't challenge themselves anymore. They don't keep striving to do their work. And they don't have an editor that has the time to sit there and go, really, you've got to go back and look at this again. You've got to go back and rewrite this. You've got to go back and rework this. They don't have that time. And because it is a business now. And money does have to be made to keep the doors open and keep books being published. It's a tough industry. It's not easy. As much as everyone thinks, great, everyone gets these seven-figure deals, there's royalties, there's massive amount of money, but there's not a lot of money.
It goes all the way.
Yeah, there's just not enough money in publishing in any aspect of it. If you like to write, write because you like to write. And if you want to get published, write, get published, and then work at it, work hard.
David? With Jonathan there because I've just had my first trilogy published and my second one's coming out next year. And so, yes, the second one, it's odd, but I felt getting the second one published, I got a bigger thrill than the first one because it's one thing, because my first one took me 10 years to write. So I don't know how many of you have bought an album, a band's first album. It's brilliant. The second one is, okay, whatever. Because they've spent their entire life and they're up to that point pouring all their creative heart and soul into that one album, one book, one trilogy, and then what do you got left?
You've been on tour for 2 years, and you've got to whack it out, and write songs in between gigs, and record as quick as you can, and it comes out, and people go,
And this is why I got the bigger thrill out of getting my second one picked up, because it meant I didn't just pour everything out of that first one. The second one's is hard work. Obviously, I haven't finished it yet.
You mean you got proof that you have talent that wasn't 10 years worth of talent crammed into one moment? You can actually do it again in 18 months or something.
I'd hesitate to use the word talent because it sounds like, hey, I got talent. But, yes. there is something gratifying about you've done something, took you 10 years, it's really good, but hey, the next one's good too.
You've still got it.
And there is something there that, I might even be able to write. This is pretty cool. And I'm also, another thing that, following on from exactly the same thing, I don't know how many of you noticed how a lot of writers write the same story over and over again. They have an idea. And then they write the same idea again with different names. And then they do it again. And if they're lucky, they might be able to do it 3 or 4 times.
But that's across the arts in general.
Absolutely.
But isn't that because the audience wants to read the same thing over and over again?
Absolutely. And in the context of raising the bar, it's, do I really want to just write the same story again? Yes, I can be an author who a certain level of readership reads because they know exactly what they're going to get. Do I want to actually push myself and do something different and feel good about the second book because, hey, this was really cool, this is different. I like the first one, it was great. The second one was really strong. And the third one, geez, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And what sort of writer do you want to be?
I see writers do improve as they go further along, hopefully.
That's the plan.
And that's the plan. Yeah. And if they do disappear, it's because they haven't spent that time and effort honing their skills and moving forward.
Certainly, we talk about this house of making the grade and how do you know you've made the grade? Well, it's not when you sell, you get your first contract or you sell your first story or wherever it is. You know you've made the grade when you keep doing it on an ongoing basis. I mean, there is a certain level of achievement in writing one good story or one good book or whatever else. There's a whole other level of achievement in doing it consistently, reliably, knowing you can. I mean, the vagaries of the market may not be kind to you, and that meant there's some very good writers, but the market isn't kind to them, and so that becomes somewhat of a second issue. But just in terms of knowing that you have made the grade. I mean, to some degree, bringing back what Pat was talking about, there's too much crap out there.
Yeah.
To some degree, the one thing that saves us a little bit, and which you and I and people who have our background, I guess, are oversensitive to because we're too aware of what's being published all the time, is that what saves you from too much crap are readers. They let it. I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff that's allowed, but it gets to find 300 people, 300 readers, and if you're willing to just not pay attention, it never made the grade. There's some stuff that you sell 300 copies of, and there's a huge impact, a very small number of things like that. So, but quite often, it's like something finds a small local audience and you can ignore it, because that's all it is. Is it too much crap, or is it too much attention?
I think the internet has changed a lot of things for writers, particularly short fiction writers, and in a very short space of time. When I first started writing short fiction, pretty much, like, if I wanted to see what was happening in America, I could get the top magazines from the newsstand, but I never got the middle magazines and the lower magazines, and then I got all the Australian stuff, and I had no idea, really, what the standard in that middle section was. Like, I knew the fantasy and science fiction. Now, I mean, you can go online for free and read all levels of what's being published, and I think that whole, there's no excuse for not knowing what's out there anymore. And it's the same with the submission process. You used to post up your submission, and like, you write a story and it might take you 2 years to get that rejected 3 times, and you never knew why it was being rejected. So now, I got a turnaround in 5 hours the other day. 5 hour rejection time.
Wow.
Yeah, they really know what they don't want. You're not sitting in this snow little pool for fermenting, wondering what's going on anymore. You go bang, bang, bang. So the speed of things has changed.
I know someone who sold the book, got the contract, signed the contract, returned the contract, and was paid in full within 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the contract was emailed to them by the publisher, they printed it out, they signed it, they put it on the scanner, they sent it back by email, then the publisher went on to PayPal, went, boom, there's $15,000, boom, and that was it, done.
Can I meet this publisher?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the internet changes all that. But what it does is it now means that you have to, as the reader, or as the commentator, or as the person pursuing a career, you have to impose your own perspective on it now. Because, you know, someone else said to me, the problem with the internet is that everybody on the internet thinks they're a dog, they get to bark. You know, everybody is, you know, stuff is made disproportionate. A really small little thing that comes from some tiny little point in Texas gets the same profile potentially as something that's published in Asimov. Or something that's published
potentially.
Or something that is printed in a 200 copy photo stat somewhere elsewhere. It's the same thing as someone paid $100,000 for out of column they did reports everywhere, potentially. And so the reader has to also be aware, and people around them have to be aware, so they impose that perspective, because we do have an enormous flood of material coming at us.
It's a noisy world, it's very, very noisy.
Yeah. I mean, I read every year for a year's best in such a fantasy volume that I publish in the States. So I'm looking at 4,000 new stories every year, I guess. And I can tell you an awful lot of them are dogs that don't need to bark. And so you have to put up filters and gateways of your own so you protect yourself from all this stuff. Because there's only so many pulpy, lesbian, vampire short stories you want to read before you start going, no, I got the point, I'm going to do something else now.
Well, there's also the issue of it with a lot of stuff, is anybody reading it? I think that the bar for certain types of horror short fiction is so low that it's actually not possible not to get one published. Like if you just, it's like you have an accident, you know, there you go. But no one reads it. And one of my bugbears is seeing people flying around the place crying off about being published authors. It's not really published. I mean, anyone, we could set up a magazine right now in this room, if we get online, and we'd have 200 submissions by Tuesday, whatever, because anyone can set themselves up as an editor. You need no qualifications, you need nothing, and people are so desperate to get published and be a published author, and it doesn't mean what it used to mean. Even 5 years ago, it meant something else.
Yeah. On the other hand, being really published, the way definitely is, means more in many ways.
But does it mean more? Because do people really know where that? I mean, do people who are not writers themselves or in the industry themselves, do they know where that line is?
I think people in the industry know where the line is.
Well, they do.
I'm not sure if outside the industry matters to some degree. I mean, because I mean, a reader will decide. I mean, there's a lot of things which obsess people who get caught up. When you start, if you're starting a writing career, there's stuff you need to know. Okay? You need to know where you can send your book, your manuscripts, how you can deal with agents. You need to know how to deal with editors. You need to know that, to your great shock, when your book is published, your job isn't over. You know, I always have a fantasy that, you know, obviously, so something magic happened. Went out the door, the manuscript went out the door, for whatever it was, and you could just walk away, and it was done.
Yes.
And then sort of you find that, you know, proof, a copy of that's come back at you, with page proofs and contracts, and then if you're not like me, so being an editor doesn't fall asleep, but I see the friends, you know, and now they want you to do a book launch and a signing. Did you do a website? Are you blogging? And do you Twitter? And,
new thing is videos of the book.
Well, you get your family and friends and pets dressed up to act out.
Because they did non-fiction books.
Oh, right? Yes.
Yeah. Non-fiction books. Wow. Textbooks, they're now doing 23-minute videos of that book. Yes. It's part of the book, part of the sales pitch, part of the marketing online.
But you know, the life cycle of your book, if it's remotely successful, means you're working at it, maybe forever. You know, like, if your book is successful, you never escape it. In a sense, so your first novel, I go out and people with the first novel, they are still looking at page proofs now. Because now is the time to deal with the third reissue and to make sure that they've caught all of the, you know, things. And if you write a book a year, you can suddenly realise, hang on, it's been a long time doing nothing but maintaining this stuff. On the other hand, somebody else told me that the original benchmark in science fiction is when do you decide to go full time and become a primary writer, right?
Yep.
When the royalties from your backlist can support you. Now, if you were to go around to writers today, generally not the field, just around the world, working, how many could actually afford to live off of that? It's a very small number.
Well, something like 3% of writers actually make it full time. Yeah. It's not easy. It's not as easy as everyone thinks. So Bevan, like, how has your life changed since your books have come out? I'm just presuming that they've had the books, but what else has changed for you? Like,
I wish you hadn't taped the.
But I mean, really, like, from what you thought was going to happen, okay, and what has happened, what has happened?
Okay. A couple of things quite distinctly have changed. I get a lot less sleep. I'm busier. I feel very different about my day job. I'm a full-time teacher. Teach high school full-time in a promotional position, so it's more than just a standard full-time teaching job. I have after-school commitments. I coach cricket on Saturday mornings. I have after-school training twice a week, etc. I'm also completing my PhD thesis in education. I'm writing the new trilogy, and occasionally doing things like coming to SwanCon as a result of my first trilogy. So first things first, I'm busier. Second thing, my bank manager is a little bit happier with me because I've now got a little bit of surplus in my mortgage because of the. I keep looking at Theresa because she's HarperCollins representative. HarperCollins was very nice to my bank manager because they gave me this little event. Lovely, 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 superlative, magnificent event, which the bank manager enjoyed very much. I'm not for you. CD player, I think. So, not being rude at all, really. But I mean, that's the thing. In terms of my childish fantasies, which I still had when I was about 40, and the reality of published with HarperCollins, got 3 books on my backlist, New Beauty, and getting up at 8 o'clock in the morning to go to work. That's the big change, is I'm busier. I'm a lot happier with my writing. Because, as you said a moment ago, and your word about the whole talent thing, it took me 10 years to get around to actually getting the courage up to send my book to anyone. That was funny because I sent it off to every literary agent in the country and I got 9 versions of How Dare You Darken My Inbox. Go away, you miserable pile of paragraphs. And then one said, yeah, not too bad, let's have another look at the rest of it. And the rest is very strange history. So, yeah. In terms of real change, nothing. I'm still doing the day job, still doing exactly what I was doing, but I'm looking forward to having a backlist.
The busiest people I know are the full-time authors. They're the ones with no time to scratch their bonnets. You know, the fantasy still persists that you sell a couple of books and then you have this. And people talk about, I might learn, when I sell my novel, I might learn a musical instrument or a foreign language or travel. And it's like, got a lot of time for finding lessons or something.
I only wrote this a couple weeks ago.
Took my rest off. It's great, but it's a different version of Happily Ever After, and nobody really talks about Happily Ever After.
Yes, after the big
song and dance. When I made it, I'm a writer, and my book has been whatever the benchmark had, whether it was I got sold, whether it was at the top of the New York Times bestsellers, whatever it might have been, there's always something else. And but one of the things I think of using is when you, not being a writer myself, I associate with writers, right? And I get stories from the English published. And you talk to them, you hear what they're trying to say. And there are all these like levels of success in your career, right? And inevitably, there is a little clique at every level complaining about all of the injustices that they suffer at their level, which the person at the level below would kill to have as a problem.
Yeah.
So at some point, Stephen King and J.K. Rowling sit around and tell each other how terrible their lives are because of all these outrageous problems they face, which nobody else would understand.
Yes. The thing with any ladder is, I've noticed throughout the whole process, is every time you go up, you can just see the next one above, or the whole view, everything swivels. So you never get what you want. I mean, you
It's not about that, though.
It's not about that, but you only work that out as you go, you go up. And
can I just add to that? I am seriously happy.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I am seriously, deeply happy with where I am with my writing at the moment, mainly because the second one's been picked up.
Yeah.
When I got my first one picked, when I got my first short story picked up and it was read on the radio on ABC, it was read out loud, they paid me $7.50 or something, and I was so happy.
Yeah.
And then I sent a couple of short stories off to a short story competition. I came second, very, very happy. Then I sent a short story off to get published. It got picked up in a magazine. Very happy. Then HarperCollins came along and said, we want to publish your trilogy. Well, you know, I didn't feel the floor for 3 or 4 days because I was just walking around on my head. Now they picked up the second one, you know, I'm bumping my head on the ceiling. It's so exciting. I'm deeply happy with where I am in terms of that. And yes, the next run is actually now visible.
Yes.
That's the exciting bit for me. I can actually see there is another run. And yeah, I'm looking forward to these problems.
What I think is weird is you're at a point as well where the thing that made you deeply happy before never becomes a bad thing.
Yeah.
But it becomes the background noise thing.
Yeah.
Of what you're doing. So like I remember when I saw like the very first anthology that I sold Harper Collins. And I mean, it was a clownishly easy thing to do, which is ridiculous. You know, like I wrote a 750-word proposal, put it on a fax machine, and the next morning they faxed me back an offer. That was it, that was the entirety of the thing. And I went, cool, great, cool. And then we did another one thing, which is great, and then we don't want to do another one. I went, oh crap. Which is fair enough. But what happened was that the elation I got with the first one, by the time you get to the 30th one, right, you just go, okay, that there is part of the business now. I'm expecting that I'll have 6 books come out every year that I've worked on. And then that I'll get about this or whatever. Now, that's just the standard step. It's that other thing that then happens every now and again that makes you go, woo, hey, this is all worth doing. And also allowing yourself to do what you're doing as well, which is to stop and go, no, this background stuff actually is still really cool.
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Oh,
well,
you again. Yes.
Anyone have any questions? Any comment? Anyone like to raise points?
I'm just wondering what the internet has done in terms of editors. I mean, you say it's only easy to get published. Well, anyone can send something as a publisher on the web. I mean, you know, $5 and you're off and running. What does that mean in terms of established print publishing houses? How does that affect? Does it have an effect?
I've seen a huge effect with print publications, small press wise. I've had a small press from 2002 through till last year. And I used to be able to sell a print run, a few hundred books, no problem, within the Australian community. And then about a year and a half ago, it all just dried up. People don't want to pay $20 to read a collection of quality fiction. I mean, this is award-winning stuff, but it wasn't for quite a minute, but pile, and I was thinking, why? What's happened? Talking to some of my American publishers, small press friends as well, same thing's happening over there. And I guess it's the internet, because you can go online and read free, high quality work without getting out of your chair. So why would you pay $20 for it? People don't really care. I mean, I was doing collections of Australian work because I wanted to promote Australian work. But I don't think, I'm not sure people really care anymore where something comes from. The global barriers are really coming down. I really perceived there was a problem with Australians selling to foreign markets once. I don't see that even there anymore. I don't think they care where you come from if you're submitting by email.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Email submissions make such a huge difference.
Yeah. It's enormous. But also, it's just, I mean, magazines like Clarksworld and, it's just...
Look, I mean, I can see that particularly your good semi-prosing level, semi-professional anthology now is seriously challenged because you can read as much short fiction pretty much as you want, but the only impact I can see it necessarily having on something like HarperCollins is some background stuff gets a bit easier because you can do it faster, really. I mean, you can throw your permanent, I've proofread 200,000 word manuscripts I've sent me with copy editors on, but then I get an email. And I open up the computer, I go over all the copy of the checks, so I can get fine, whatever, and email it back. So you save having to, you know, express post it to Sydney or FedEx it to New York, whatever it is. but it's background administrative stuff.
Yeah.
You do get a chance. The textbook, the one thing that the internet can give you maybe is a chance to, as a author, is to pick up other markets by making yourself known a little bit. But, you know, by and large, it doesn't facilitate, you know, the book sale angle particularly at all.
No, the book sale angle doesn't affect. Well, you're talking about the professional sort of novel length stuff.
Or, yeah.
And the big print runs. I think it's killing off small press.
Yes. And yet, you know, sort of, what I think about it, sorry, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I look around and say, there's an awful lot of semi-print also, small press anthologies coming out right now. And some of them are selling really well. Which is a paradox, because I mean, I was saying to you yesterday, I edit books from Nightshade Books in San Francisco, who are a big small press, like one of the large urban sort of small presses. And they've just done two books, reprint books, one of post-apocalyptic science fiction stories, one of werewolves, for zombie stories. Now, the post-apocalyptic book is called Wastelands, the other one is called The Living Dead. How many copies do you think a reprint anthology of zombie stories from Nightshade Press will sell?
Oh, zombies are the new black, you know.
Many guys.
Oh. 6,000. To be fair,
60,000
copies. That's a buy.
60,000 copies.
That is really interesting.
So, you know, one thing that's happened, one of the weird things, by the way, in the background here is with this recession and as the world crumbles, all your books look like good value.
Yeah.
For your entertainment dollar. Whether you're going down to the used bookstore because that's legitimate. Or whether you are buying a book in a bookstore or going to the library, you don't know what they're talking about right now. Which is, everyone's going, oh, you know, a lot of this sort of chaos in New York, that I don't know if you guys follow much. I have to. You see, you know, the reprints are disappearing, age old, you know, things are merging and changing. A significant proportion of it is efficiencies that they wanted to do anyway, but they couldn't really because the unions would have backed up it. But now, with everything in collapse, well, hey, we can change this sec. This something got rid of 300 people. Suddenly, grass guru doesn't exist anymore. They've been absorbed over here, and blah, blah, blah. And they're all setting it because they're making money anyway.
Publishing in America is really different to Australia.
It's amazing. Yeah, 60,000.
That's a lot of zombies.
That's a. Even for a regular press, that's not a bad run.
No, that's a very good run.
Yeah. I mean, the print runs in America, I mean, people do talk about the price of books in America compared to Australia. The print runs in America are astronomical compared to Australia. It's just, you know, economy of scale.
And also the fact that things like shipping to your nearest market is not what it was. I mean, here, they print them in, I think, in Adelaide. They go to Sydney for distribution or something, and they go around the country.
Yes.
They get these vast areas around them to cover, and all gets paid for. There, if you print it in, well, fuck either of them, you've only got to send it 10 kilometres to start selling it, sort of deal. I mean, usually they print a warehouse in middle America somewhere where it's cheap, and they send that from there. And yes, I mean, the thing that's the weirdest thing is still the shipping thing.
The shipping, and the returns percentages in America are phenomenal. We're talking high double digits, and it's economically unviable the way they print over there. Australian printing is radically different.
Yes.
And I don't know, it's going to be a big shake-up in America if they take on what we do here. Australia is forced, just because of scale, we're forced to think on our feet and constantly try new things. Whereas America and England have sort of been stuck in the old times, and they're now being dragged screaming and kicking into the 21st century. And it's going to hurt, and some of the big dollars have paid out to authors. The way the royalties, or not royalties, the upfront fees are at the moment is, again, completely uneconomical, it's unviable, it's ridiculous, you don't make your money back, and that's going to be interesting to see if that changes in the future.
So for how long until print on demand becomes viable?
It's already
viable now, but the problem is browsing.
Yeah.
It's that whole thing of browsing.
Same with Amazon.
I mean, books are never going to be replaced. This will still exist. It's never going to be replaced. But when you go shopping into a bookstore, what will happen is there will be a terminal there where you can do your downloads.
Yeah.
That's all it will be. It's just another app.
So it's backwards.
For backwards.
I can certainly see that
being
backwards easily.
But yeah, backwards will be available as well. It's just going to be how do you want it? So really, do you want it on your mobile phone? Do you want it this way? Do you want it in hardcover? Do you want it in paperback? You will be able to go into
I mean, A&R at the moment are trying that print on demand, and this massive machine they've got in some of the stores in Sydney and Melbourne, where you can go in and they can print the book up from there and then. At the moment, they can only print because they've got a very limited range of what they can print. For the future, you'll be able to actually go to a print shop.
Does it come out as a book or as a loose leaf?
No, it comes out as a book.
Yeah.
Comes out as a book.
Cover it all.
How much do you charge for that?
About $30, $35.
So that drops to $15. Something becomes.
Yeah. From my first book that was sold on the internet was print on demand. Still running. I sold a copy in 2007.
Hence, the answer is a self-publishing.
No, it was a
self-publishing. But the one problem with PO, the only problem with PO and everything else is you still have to market and distribute.
Yes.
That's the other hidden part.
Yeah.
It's not these days a great challenge to produce book.
No.
You know, the back to skill barrier, I mean, frankly, you can find people on the net where you can basically email them your complete file and they will mail you back a book.
So the word publishing means...
It doesn't mean,
like, you can run off 500 books and put them in your garage, you have not published a book.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just one thing, sorry. If you're a writer, one thing always, always know, money flows to you. If the money doesn't flow to you in the book relationship, it's corrupt and don't do it. When I met a woman at a convention I've released last year, a year before. She said that her editor was editing her book and it was going to come out shortly. The second one, people really wanted it. She'd only have to pay $15 a copy to get them. I'm going, what? I send them money and they send me the books. I said, oh, they're a printer. She said, no, my editor works there. And so, and basically, these companies exist where they, in effect, rip off.
Yeah.
Unsuspecting, you know, writers or whatever else. So always remember, if you go to write, the money flows to you. That's where it goes.
I was just going to throw a question out. As a consumer, I was, you know, took an interstate trip, wandered down to the local airport bookshop, not a great example of the best distributions. But talking about things like trilogies, they seem very popular at the moment. A lot of multi-series books are coming out. But I scanned the shelves, and at least 50% of the stuff there was book two or book three or something or other. And I'm not interested in jumping into a series part way. I mean, publishers and authors, is it a problem in terms of the market? I mean, because I literally had to discount 50% of the books on display that looked interesting, but they didn't have book one on the shelf. Because, you know,
you can't go by an airport store.
No, I know you can't, but it exists for other series too. I mean, I can wander into a major bookshop and they will have the new release on display, but they may or may not actually be stocking.
And wonderful bookstores in Perth are Planet, Oxford Street, New Edition. They're lovely, lovely independent
bookstores.
In Fremantle.
Great.
Wonderful bookstores. For your more literary end of the market is Claremont and Subiaco. They're wonderful. Garden City has a fantastic range of fantasy. They're just lovely people there.
They gave me a whole shelf when my second book came out. By Pimmick's, wonderful. Love them.
Yeah.
Love them to death.
Pimmick's Carousel. They are working their way back into. They used to have a brilliant fantasy department. They're building it back up. Stefan, of course, out at Borders. Well, Borders was wonderful. There are some really great little bookshops out there. And when you find them, support them. They offer you incredible service, and staff who are in there love books, they have knowledge, they can recommend you what to read, what's coming out, keep you informed, and they're the ones to support.
Yeah, there's nothing nicer than going to a bookshop and you can say, look, I love this, and they go, oh, I suggest this, and you actually are pleased with the purchase you make. Yeah.
I'm going to add in a plug as well for Fantastic Planet and White Dwarf in the city.
I apologise. How fuck to get those? Oh my god. Fantastic Planet, of course, and White Dwarf, they are wonderful bookshops because they have all the incredible backlists. And if it's not available in Australia, they do bring the imports in. But then they have staff who are passionate. Passionate about fantasy.
And something I really like about White Dwarf is you go in there and there's the whole series. One, two, three, four, all done.
Right, that's what I want.
And
yeah, I was not be afraid to start a series and know that I'll get to the end of it.
We'll try our best.
I was in there on Thursday, and I was looking around, and thought, oh, what was that series? Oh, there it is, one, two, three. Oh, cool. You know, the whole series, and great, love it, just superb the way that's set up. Especially because I looked up and there was, my, one, two, three. Oh, it was lovely.
and two things. Firstly, commercially, having a whole series, 1, 2, 3, isn't that the best way bookstore can do cross-selling far more effectively than the author variety pack?
Yes.
And the second question is, even though Google is now better than God, because it's superseded God, I think it's superseded God recently, isn't it the case that a human who knows their stuff is a far more useful source of information, like someone like Stephen Devon in a bookstore, about I like this, I don't like that, I found that, I like that author, but I thought that book was crap.
Yeah.
And giving him that sort of information, who should I read? Google can't answer that question.
No, I wasn't sure as such.
Yeah.
The independent bookstores at this time, because the economy is difficult, I mean, books, can't say they were recession proof, but they are still selling. And the bookstores that are doing extremely well are the independents that have the staff that hand sell, the ones that care. And they are the ones that are doing extremely well, and the ones that say have book 1, 2, 3, 1 to 5, 1 to 7. Was it how many Robert Jordan got out now? 1 to 10? They are the ones that have that. You know, they have the entire series. Yes, so quite correct. That does make sense.
If they've got such a massive range of stock, which means that they have less shelf space for whatever came out last week, does that cost them sales when there's a stock out of the latest new thing? Because they don't have the shelf space to be a new shelf space for old stuff. And they're paying in primary retail more than grams per letter.
Yes, potentially it does. Yes, potentially. They do have, you have to have bulk stock of what was on Oprah last week. You have to have bulk stock of what's going to be in the Women's Weekly this week. You have to have bulk stock of what's going to be on television that night.
Well, it'd be fantastic, Fanny. You need 20 copies of the new last price to bring it on.
The latest
not,
release.
Not
yeah.
Because that's what people are going to want immediately.
Yeah.
And so it's always a trade-off.
Yeah.
Remember, the good trade-off with independent stores like Fantastic and White Dwarf for us. We've got that back stock. The trade-off is that we keep all that old stock in there. That's likely will come to us. That's where our business is. Mm-hmm. Whereas you go to A&R, you'll get that massive chunk of new books and stuff.
No, if you want what's new this week, don't bother hanging out to Johnson. How much cheaper?
So the point, you love the bookshelf.
Hangouts for underpants.
Yeah, I was just
going to
say the underpants
thing.
Go buy it if
you're
there.
Yeah.
No.
I was wondering about novels. It seems like you can't buy a novel under 400 pages these days. Is that, if you actually write something that's less than that, will people still look at it, or do you have to?
Can I just say, just very quickly, talking to novelists I know, increasingly yes, actually.
Okay.
Particularly in America, they are tending towards shorter books because they're cheaper to print, cheaper to ship, they get more copies out, it's easier. It varies from place to place, and I know for a while, particularly, it's like if you could make a 200,000 word book, a 250,000 word book, they were happier. Heck, they'd print a 60,000, 80,000 word book on thicker paper, they'd look thicker if they had to. But now, more
that size is okay. Anything smaller than that,
you struggle.
So, how many words is that though?
130,000.
Okay, that's interesting. Because just on that, my recent experience when my first book was published, when I first sent what I thought was the first book of that series into my then agent, she said, "How long is it?" And I said, "Oh, it's 95,000. She said, "No, no bother." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, no one will look at something under 110. They won't even look at it under 110. Now, I don't know how true that is, but that's what she told me. So I went back and wrote it up to 140.
And when they said make it
shorter. Yeah. No, they were happy with
140.
No,
obviously, that's not true. It also depends if you're talking about the young adult market or the adult market.
Yeah. Oh, so market.
Neil Gaiman can write, not Neil Gaiman, but he can write The Graveyard Book, which is, I think, maybe 60,000-65,000 words tops.
Yeah.
And sell millions and millions and millions and millions of them. Cory Doctorow of the adult science fiction market, his first handful of novels were under 80,000 words.
When was that?
That was between 2003 and now.
Okay.
And they sold very, 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 very well. And I don't know how well Little Brother is selling me, which is a YA adult crossover title, but it's not much more than 80,000 words.
No, see, it's YA. If you're talking fantasy, you want chunk.
Yeah.
Chunky, definitely.
People want immersion.
Yeah.
Fantasy readers love their the complexity.
Yes, I think all about all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just on Little Brother, did the free giveaway as an e-book actually increase hard copy sales?
I don't know if there's any objective way of knowing for a fact. I know Corey believes it. And I certainly know that the sales were so high that Tor didn't care. And also the thing is, it's like, okay, Corey's a bad example because it's his shtick. I mean, it's really the thing he does. He goes out, he was with the Electronic Frontier Foundation for a while, he goes out and gets one coin, and he encourages all his people, you know, like, if you want to support me, don't give me money, go buy my book, and if you've read it, you don't want to buy it and give it to somebody else. And such is his personal following that they will go do this, they'll go and they'll buy it. So his books, so Tor and certain now HarperCollins, who publish it, are quite comfortable with this idea that yes, the book comes out from them, and at the same time you go read the whole book online if you want it. But the other thing is, I've read books online. It's not a big joy. I own a Sony Reader and I love my Sony Reader, but reading novels is still not a big joy in my book.
Yeah. But it's nice to check out if you're going to enjoy it.
I will say that probably it's helped grow as an audience overall. I don't know if there's a direct correlation to hard copy sales, which is what you asked, but overall, do I think it helped him? Sure. Because anybody who goes online can go read a whole big chunk of Corey Doctorow and decide if they like him. And then, and it's like, it's what he says, it's what Gaiman repeats all the time. Your greatest worry in this world as a writer is not theft, it's obscurity.
If you go to most of the websites now, Amazon, HarperCollins' own website, Penguin website, all of them have pretty much embraced browsing site, and you can actually read the first, three to five chapters of any book that's out there. The biggest problem with the internet is finding what you want to read, because there's so much. But you can't browse the internet.
Diane
has at
least that free library, which has lots of books on the trade.
And that's done extremely well for them. Mm-hmm. And you can see other publishers trying to increase them. In the States, HarperCollins give away novels online that you can read. Tor do it routinely, they'll do it one or two a month. You take a PDF or an RTF to find a book and read it, whatever you want.
Yeah, we have browse. We have, you can sign up and you can get advanced proofs, advanced copies. It's got a sort of competition there. And all we want back is sort of, did you enjoy it? That's all. And there are so many things online that all publishers do, which nobody takes advantage of. I don't think anyone knows they're there.
Sorry.
I was saying, I didn't know that.
It is getting that taste. It's like one of the biggest things that happened to Pulp from Garth Nix, he was telling me, was in the UK a couple of years back, when the last Harry Potter book came out, it was bundled free with the first book in Garth's latest series. Which means 12 million people got a copy. And yes, 11.5 million threw it at the bin and went, well, all of that. But halfway got rent. And then they got the second one, third one, the fourth one. And actually, if you're talking about it as a career, Garth is always do what Garth does. Garth is smarter than we all are.
Yes.
Better informed than we all are. This is the idea. How do you make sure you make a fortune as a writer? Okay. You start off, you write a bunch of books for little kids. Like Lucasfilm paid to write a bunch of books for 7 to 12 year olds, right? Then you write a YA series, and then you write some adult books, and then you write some more, and whatever. And what it means is that the kid who picks up your book when he's 7, by the time he's 14, he's still reading you. And by the time he's 18, he's still reading you.
Oh, that's evil.
It's absolutely
brilliant. Hey, I suddenly feel better because I've just submitted a children's book for 6 to 8 HarperCollins. And I've got another book for 12 to 14 year olds.
It's a great thing.
You've already got the adult stuff.
We've got that, but backwards, but hey.
So,
12 to 14.
We have some books to give away from our lovely promotional partners, White Dwarf, Planet Books, and HarperCollins Cross. So can we have the last 5 questions here, of course?
So why is HarperCollins doing all the other publishers?
Because we publish the best authors. You have a choice.
No, you didn't expect something to work on that.
Can I say, I love working with HarperCollins.
Me too.
What's happening?
Some people
still producing anthologies, but they're doing them as online things instead to cut out the cost of printing. Some people are pushing on with it, and some people like me are throwing in the towel because it's just too hard. That's not the only reason I'm throwing in the towel. Small presses have a short life anyway because you're against it the whole way. I mean, you get involved because you want to contribute to your community, not because you ever think you're going to make any money whatsoever out of it. So, like Jonathan said, don't really get the book.
Can I just say go down to the dealer's room and buy some stuff?
Yeah, the best thing, if you want to help, just go and buy a small press book. But there are people down there that in the dealer's room doing, small press is going. Great guns is Western Australia at the moment. That's where all the, with the Alexa Christmas themes, 12 Planet Press and Russell Farr's Tycoon Dragon Press, they're pumping the stuff out. But they haven't become old and jaded and bitten and twisted like me. but it's really difficult. It's a difficult thing. But as Jonathan's pointed out, there are small businesses in America that are doing awesome stuff. I think we were always up against it in Australia, just on simple population based terms. The most I could ever sell on my side was just 500 books. The best I could do without a distributor. That's pretty good, and I realised that that wasn't such a shabby number, but I was unable to use a distributor because there was not one that would do the job. I would have happily run at a loss to use a distributor if I could find one that would do the job. And I wouldn't. For a small thing. So you're forced to do it yourself, and you have a life. Really for me it was writing. I want to write now, that's all I want to do. But you have to hand sell at bookshops, you have to hand sell at conventions, you have to be on the internet doing all of that too. You have got to try and violently force people to buy your book.
That's the Simon Haynes story. That's why Simon Haynes has been successful.
He's a very good success story actually. He self-published his own books, got a couple in, I think it was Ademics, and he was picked up by a major publisher through Ademics in the book up going, oh, we could sell this. That doesn't happen with anthologies of Australian short fiction.
Last question, sorry.
Is there an advantage to being published in small press prior to approaching major publishers? Do you even look at that, or is pitching a book to
editors? By and large, they pitch a book to small press. By and large, they pick you when they want you. Because that's the nature of it, It's some enthusiasm that I want to get out. Pitch your books to major publishers, really.
They're separate things, like short fiction and doesn't necessarily lead to long fiction. Some people only ever want to write short fiction. Yeah. And there isn't a lot of opportunity with major publishers doing anthologies. I mean, there's probably one, half a dozen one every 4 years or something.
Yeah. Every year.
Open cattle call? No. See, you've got to be on their books already to get in them. But, Jack Dan's streaming again was open to submissions. I think that was still an invite thing, but it was quite a wide call. So if you are a short story writer and you want to get published, you have got to go to small presses or magazines. You don't have another option.
What is the market like on series, like teenage series like Goosebumps or Saddle Club now? Like,
huge. It's still there. Saddle Club, not so much, but there are new series that are sort of coming up. Beyond that, Goosebumps are actually making a sort of comeback. They're reissuing a lot of them, and they terrified me when I was 10 years ago when they were at the height of popularity. I mean, have you read one of those? They are absolutely scary. I have not read, but they are making a comeback, and R.L. Stine continues to keep writing and writing and writing.
I didn't know that.
Anyone knows,
they
just keep
pumping
out there.
Is it
different?
No.
But Jonathan Green, you can try and ask the question for about now.
maybe it's because I came late, so maybe it's already been discussed before, but does having a piece of your short fiction published, would that help you if you had a longer novel you're trying to sell? Would that help you?
I wouldn't think so. If your goal is to sell your novel, your goal is to sell your novel. And if you have a nice, vibrant short fiction, not one sale, but a vibrant career that's got you all kinds of
attention or whatever else, that will get maybe get something to pay a bit more attention to you at the beginning in terms of actually reading your proposal and your 3 chapters or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, it's your proposal, your 3 chapters, the book you wrote, not anything else, because that's what people are going to buy, that's what people are going to think they can sell. So you've got to get that right and then get it in the hands probably of an agent somehow, and then get that into a publisher. That's the only way it's going to work.
Can I just add to that just a little bit?
Yeah.
From personal experience, what I did was I wrote a few short stories. Now, I don't write short stories. I feel a bit out of place, I think, because I'm not good at short stories. But I wrote a couple, and then I submitted a novel to an internet publisher, which they picked up. But what I found was at each stage, I was able to say, would you be interested in looking at this? Because I've already had these published.
Mm.
And as you're saying, I think it got a foot in the door. So when I wrote to the agent who picked me up briefly said, you've been published. She actually said, well, I can see you've been published, so you've got something that allows you to actually think you can write. So, yeah, okay, I'll have a look at what you've written. So in terms of getting published, it helps a little bit.
But I mean, on the other hand, I mean, J.K. Rowling, you've only written one thing before.
Yeah.
I had one experience
I had recently.
We've got to go.
Thank you.